Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me today, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everybody. Make sure to thank Kat because she's recording this instead of playing FIFA.
I want to play all of the sports games right now. Sports games are like RPGs. That's what I say every year. That should be my catchphrase.
We'll put it on your headstone. Sports games are RPGs, you dolt.
Yeah, I've been head down all week with different sports game reviews. I wrote an NHL 19 review. I wrote an NBA 2K19 review as of the recording of this podcast. And now I'm playing FIFA.
Yeah.
But once FIFA's done, I'll be out of the sports game realm and I can go back to playing Dragon Quest XI.
That's good to hear. I look forward to talking Dragon Quest XI with you. It's always funny, though. I'm always in the States around the time NFL comes out, and I just like all the ads and stuff they have for NFL, or it's back home. It's like, hey, NHL, everyone, buy this game, please.
NHL is better than usual this year, but it's very much flying under the radar compared to all of the other sports games. But people often ask me, and I've related this on the podcast more than once, they go, Kat, you like RPGs, but also you like sports games. Gua? I don't understand the connection. And I always say, well, the connection perhaps will become apparent if you understand that Madden is just Pokemon, but with large, beefy football men.
Can they, like, breathe fire?
Man, I wish. That'd be an incredible thing to see from Le'Veon Bell or something. Sometimes I think Aaron Rodgers can turn into a fucking dragon and kill everybody. That guy is unstoppable. I hate him. Though, hopefully, by the time this podcast goes up, my beloved Minnesota Vikings will have defeated the Green Bay Packers in Lambeau Field. So
I'm rooting for you.
I am rooting for me, too. Thank you. All right. So this we have a few things to discuss, Nadia. We're going to talk about the Nintendo Direct announcements that were made last week as of the release of this podcast. And also, we got a special guest joining me will be Brian Fargo, who is the legendary RPG developer and also the founder of In Exile Entertainment. He's had a bit of a big week this week with the release of Bard's Tale 4, the recent release of the Bard's Tale Remastered Trilogy, and also Wasteland 2 on Nintendo Switch. There's a lot going on, so we'll talk about that, and we'll also maybe talk a little bit about Wasteland 3. But first of all, Nadia, last week, there was a big Nintendo Direct. Tons of news. Way more news than I was actually really expecting from this one.
Yeah, a Nintendo Directs always kind of surprise you. I always go into them thinking, oh, they probably won't have that much to really talk about. I'm sure they'll just, you know, a couple of Switch games here, a couple of 3DS games there. And it's always pretty big. There's always at least something really big coming out of Directs these days.
Yeah, I was caught a little bit off guard because I went in going, oh, well, you know, they more or less kind of announced everything. Civ 6 coming to the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a game I'm never going to play.
Yeah.
City Skylines, okay. Mega Man 11 demo, fine, whatever. But instead they were like, no, Animal Crossing, right here. Animal Crossing character in Smash Brothers.
Yep.
All of the Final Fantasy, and also a new Game Freak RPG. And I'm like, okay, just, no, stop. Oh, Luigi's Mansion 3, too. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were all going crazy trying to keep up with the news. I was having trouble enough just live-tweeting it. You guys in Slack trying to keep up with the news. I felt really bad for you guys.
Before we move on to the RPGs, can I just say that I'm secretly excited for the new Super Mario Brothers U on the Switch?
I do feel like that one got overlooked because the Wii U, of course, wasn't exactly a hot seller. And that was a very good Wii U game.
Not by Polygon. They named it the best Mario ever made.
I wouldn't go that far.
Jeremy Parrish did that, by the way. And I kid Jeremy. But I know that he was just trying to shake things up and do something a little bit different. And New Super Mario Brothers U is actually a very good Mario game. I think it's the best New Super Mario Brothers game by far, like in terms of platformers.
I think I prefer 3D World. If you're talking about 2D New Super Mario Brothers games, then yeah, I would easily say that's the best one.
What if I told you I don't like the 3D games?
I'd say you're wrong.
We'll move on in a second, but let's see. If there are certain flavors of Mario game, there's like the Odyssey games, which I like. Odyssey/Galaxy. I like those.
Right.
There are the 2D games, which would be like New Super Mario Brothers. They can be a little plain, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Mario World, hard to top, right?
Right.
And then there are the Mario World, Mario 3D Land family. And I enjoyed the chaos of Mario 3D World. It was fine. It was enjoyable, but it's not my favorite, and I don't care if it ever comes to Switch. I know I'm in the minority, a lot of people, but I do care about pure, straight-up platforming, and New Super Mario Bros. U gives that to me, so I'm very excited about that. But let's talk about something other than Mario, okay? Let's talk about Final Fantasy coming to the Switch.
Yes, all the Final Fantasies, including the first one they announced was 12, the Zodiac Age, and I think Parrish said he needed a moment because he was just overwhelmed with emotion.
Oh, poor Parrish has been Final Fantasy 12's foremost defender for a long time. Parrish loves to fight for the underdog, as evidenced by the New Super Mario Brothers U thing. I kid Jeremy, yeah. I kid him. But with Final Fantasy 12, having it on the Nintendo Switch is awesome. No other way to put it. It's a great way. It'll be a great way to enjoy a overlooked gem, I feel. We've talked about it extensively on this podcast. I thought the HD remaster that came out last year was outstanding.
It was. Full stop. It was actually my first time playing Final Fantasy XII, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. It had a remastered soundtrack. It was just great all around, and I think it's going to be a tremendous fit for the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, I'll probably go ahead and buy it again. I really like the world of Ivalice. I think it's by far Square Enix's most well-developed world going on in the Final Fantasy universe.
Yeah, I think that, and I think we can thank Matsuno for that one. But
definitely.
But in addition to Final Fantasy XII, we're also getting Final Fantasy X, Final Fantasy X-2 HD, which I think was... Everybody was kind of wondering, like, where the heck are these? Why did it take so long? Because...
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, they're on everything else. They're on the freaking Vita, for God's sake.
Well, ta-da.
Ta-da. So, yeah, it felt pretty natural to finally bring those over to Nintendo Switch. And, hey, you should finally play them, Nadia.
Yeah, I finally will. I promise I will, finally.
Though, I will say that Final Fantasy X is not the greatest fit for a... portable system because it has a lot of unskippable cutscenes. It's very kind of, it's an old school PS2 experience. It straddles the line between PS1 and PS2 in many respects. Its pace is very deliberate.
Right.
The battles are very slow, actually. People forget how slow the battles are in Final Fantasy X. So it is a fine game, but not the kind of game I would be wanting to play on the road.
I wonder if they're going to, you know, just kind of give you that option to speed it up a bit. Because I remember Final Fantasy IX, playing that on the PlayStation 4, it was a little bit faster, and of course you had the options to really speed things up if you wanted to.
Yeah. In addition to Final Fantasy X and X-2, oh my gosh, they also announced Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy IX are coming to Nintendo Switch. I'm excited for Final Fantasy VII. I have not played Final Fantasy VII in a decade, it's time. It's time to go.
Yeah, I'm sitting here like an idiot saying, yeah, I'm going to play this again for what must be like the 50th time since it came out. But I really want it for my Switch. What can I say?
I haven't properly finished Final Fantasy VII since 2000, probably.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you're really going to have fun going back to it and saying or seeing what Square Enix really intended for this weird-ass game that I just love to death.
Well, the problem I've always had is I always get kind of slowed up in Midgar. Like, I don't feel like the game truly picks up until you fight Shinra. Because there's that initial bit where you're in the Mako reactors. And that's exciting. That's fun.
It is. Yeah, that's a really cool intro.
And then everything, like, grinds to a halt for the most part. And, like, everything to do with Aeris, pretty boring, in my opinion. Where you're pushing barrels down onto Turk soldiers, boring.
I can never get that. Like, I always screw up the barrel part.
Everybody loves the cross-dressing quest, but actually that quest was extremely boring and I hated it. Oh, the Don Corneo stuff.
No, you're absolutely right. I could actually honestly skip that by now.
Yeah, no, for sure. It lives in infamy, but mm-hmm. it was like a bad episode of an anime.
It really was. It was a little bit cliche, wasn't it?
Just a little bit. And I mean, but of course, at the time, we didn't care. And then, like, when I used to play Final Fantasy VII back in the day when I was in high school, and I swear to God, I beat that game 100 times, I would just be marking time until we finally got to Shinra headquarters, at which point the game, like, just really took off. And then you'd get to the overworld, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, this is great. This is wonderful. I love this game. So, but I'm looking forward to playing it.
Yeah, me too.
One game that is missing from the bunch and was deserving a lot of commentary, receiving a lot of notice from people, Final Fantasy VIII.
Yes. Yeah,
no Final Fantasy VIII. What I called the best one.
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay, I wouldn't go that far either. I don't think Final Fantasy VIII is the best one. It's just first best in my heart.
Okay, that's fair. It's one I honestly would not mind giving another try, because I played it on the PlayStation 1 back in the day. I just did not like it. So if it came out on the Switch, I'd be like, sure, I'll give this another download. I'll give it another try. But why isn't it there? That is so odd.
I don't think it's odd, because Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy IX are available on PC and mobile, I think. And
I thought 8 was, too.
And PS4, but not 8. Well, I mean, 8 is available on PC, but it's slightly different than the PC port of Final Fantasy VII.
Is it not on PlayStation 4? I never checked.
Okay, let me take a step back. Final Fantasy VII is on PS4. Final Fantasy IX is on PS4. Final Fantasy VIII is not on PS4.
Oh, okay.
And these are the versions that are getting moved over to Switch.
Of course, that makes a little sense.
And there's a reason that Final Fantasy VIII isn't available. Because Final Fantasy VII is, of course, the big one, the most popular one. Final Fantasy IX is the critically acclaimed, successful one, the one that Hironobu Sakaguchi consistently says is his favorite in the series. Mm-hmm. And also there's Final Fantasy VIII.
Yeah, just kind of sandwiched in the middle. The middle child. I relate to the middle child of the series.
It's the one that everybody always goes, oh, Final Fantasy VIII, blah, blah, blah. Well, folks, let me tell you something. I like Final Fantasy VIII. I tweeted earlier on Friday. I still have fond memories of FF8's quirky world, the soundtrack, the bizarro story, the lunar cry, and that killer final boss battle. But I expect it doesn't hold up, owing to how boring the draw mechanic is. And everybody pointed out that there's triple triad, and you can just refine all the cards into spells anyway, which I always did.
Yeah, that's a good point. That was the thing that turned me off Final Fantasy VIII when I was younger, was just the battle system. I really liked the story. I even kind of like Squall, even though he's a douche. I really like Laguna. I love the soundtrack. It's absolutely gorgeous. So, yeah, like I said, I wouldn't mind replaying it, but I'm not going to be doing that for a while, I guess.
So when it comes to Final Fantasy VIII, I think I've said this before on this podcast, but with Final Fantasy VII, it was very accessible, right? Like, it was very straightforward. Even if you didn't know a lot about RPGs, you could just jump right in and play Final Fantasy VII and appreciate it. It turned a lot of people into anime. And then Final Fantasy VIII comes out, and it is big. It is bold. It is gorgeous. It is huge. And it is complicated. It is surprisingly complicated. It is full of tutorials trying to explain its crazy-ass junction system. People just didn't get it. People are going, what the heck is going on? Where's Cloud?
Why isn't Cloud in Final Fantasy VIII? Oh, my sweet summer child. You don't know how Final Fantasy works, I suppose.
What is this world? And so a lot of people just leaned on summons. And then they were like, oh, well, summons are boring. What the heck is going on? If you dug in deeper, and this was the first time that I really dug in deep and broke an RPG over my knee, you discovered something weird and wonderful and delightful, to be perfectly honest. I discovered that the spells aren't actually that important. Final Fantasy VII, you press a button, you get Fire 3, boom, enemies are dead, right? Faraga and Final Fantasy VIII, it's not that good. It's all right. Not compared to a powered up attack from your sword that has an elemental damage. Not compared to some of the really strong stuff that you can get. Summons aren't nearly as powerful as limit breaks. I barely even use summons after the initial battle. And I like the world a lot in Final Fantasy VIII. I think that it is one of the best realized and most interesting and underrated worlds out there. It's certainly this kind of crazy sci-fi world with time travel and sorceresses. Mm-hmm. And I like it.
Well, there's one thing that one of the things that spoiled it for me a little bit is God, I think it was Sharky who said that epic opening movie with what's his name and Squall doing that sword fight, it turned out they're just like having a schoolyard fight. when you start the game, you're like, oh, I guess he's right. And now they're going to go to the cafeteria and eat hot dogs. Okay.
But it was a statement of intent from the game.
It sure was.
It was saying, look how friggin' epic this game is. And it was epic. It was awesome.
It was very, very theatrical.
But for me, the moment where Final Fantasy... If Final Fantasy VII truly gets started in Shinra, the moment when Cloud is riding down the stairs on his motorcycle... Or perhaps the moment that you're standing on the rooftop fighting Rufus, or the moment that you see Sephiroth stabbed through the... Or not Sephiroth. You see the President Shinra stabbed through the heart with Sephiroth's sword. But the moment that Final Fantasy VIII really starts for me is that moment when it's playing the song, I believe it's called The Landing, mm-hmm. and you see Squall's like doing a Normandy Beach kind of storm yes. beaches kind of thing.
Yes, I remember that.
And that incredible music is playing. Yeah. Oh, man, that was so epic. The cutscenes were so good. The cutscenes in Final Fantasy VIII were really on another level. And then you get to hear the battle music for the first time, which is excellent. You had a huge chase scene with a boss. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, by and large, like, that was just a really epic action scene all around. And then it slows down again a little bit. But
okay, yeah, I do remember the storm, the Normandy Beach scene quite well. I remember the commercial used it as well to promote the game. I guess they were trying to emulate the success of Final Fantasy VII's commercial, which was very, again, theatrical. And I noticed they kind of used like a whole bunch of... They did the same thing where they used a whole bunch of cutscenes and didn't really show you the gameplay itself. But the cutscenes looked good. Actually, they looked very good.
The game itself looked really good.
It did.
It was a huge step up visually from Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, I was impressed by what a step up it was.
Did you ever take the seed exam?
I don't remember if I did or not. I can't remember what it entailed.
I always liked that. Well, so the whole point of that opening scene on the beach was that it was a test.
Okay.
You weren't just storming the beaches and helping to liberate a radio tower that had been taken over. By Galbadia, I believe it was called. You were in the middle of a test, so you were asked a lot of scenarios that you had to deal with, like right in the moment. For example, mm-hmm. if you were able to escape, if you managed to do it so where you only fought the robot that chased you once,
uh-huh.
you would get maximum points. If you managed to, you had to figure out how to deal with Cypher. Who was, you know, unruly and would be trying to basically undermine your authority at every opportunity.
So he was Cypher, basically.
Because he was Cypher. He was a dick. that played into your score. There were right. a lot of little things, actually, and I always enjoyed that.
It's actually kind of funny the way you describe it is the way... I haven't taken a test for like service work in many years, but nowadays they ask you all these weird cryptic questions before they even let you apply for a job, and it kind of reminds me of that.
If you were to ask to steal a thing, would you?
Yes. Why didn't I get hired? What's going on?
But it also, of course, tied into your salary at the start of the game, and
yes.
you could actually
okay.
end up earning a lot of money, like a ridiculous amount of money if you... Right. look up everything that you need to do early on.
Right. That was one of the things that pissed me off about the game. I remember now because I was driving around in a car. First of all, I was very offended that I had to drive around in a car. And while I was just kind of exploring, my salary went down because I wasn't earning it. I'm like, you know what? Screw this. Why am I playing Job the game? I'm out of here.
I would probably play Final Fantasy VIII on the Switch, to be honest. I think I would rather play Final Fantasy VIII than Final Fantasy VII or IX, because I just, out of all of the PlayStation Final Fantasies, I have the most nostalgia for that one, because that was always mm-hmm. my game. So
okay, I understand that, and I would definitely give it a try, although I have to say that I did return Final Fantasy VIII, and I got Suikoden 2, which is a good trade-off, if you ask me.
No, that's not a bad trade-off at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, in addition to Final Fantasy 7, 9, 10, 10, 2, and 12, many of which are coming to the Xbox One, I might mm-hmm. add, which is actually kind of momentous because it's the first time these games are actually on it. A whole bunch of other games, including World of Final Fantasy, which, I mean, whatever, like you could stack characters on top of one another.
That was a weird, cute game. I remember playing the demo and enjoying it, but not really enough to buy the full thing.
I remember Parrish liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah,
a whole bunch of people are enjoying World of Final Fantasy. Not really my thing, even though I normally like all-star team-up type games. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's going to be on Nintendo Switch and Xbox One and PS4. And also, Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles coming to Nintendo Switch.
That is a very interesting game, because I remember it was the first game that Square Enix made after they and Nintendo made up after their big breakup over the Nintendo 64.
Yeah, made up, quote unquote.
Quote unquote, yeah.
As in, like, Square Enix was allowed through the door.
Nobody had a gun trained on them anymore as they came in through the door, yeah.
Yeah, there were... If you ever read Matt Leone's huge oral history of Final Fantasy VII...
I did, it was fantastic.
The stories range vary a little bit when it comes to the... vary a little bit when it comes to Nintendo's following out with Square Enix, but... Mm-hmm. Some of them were saying Nintendo understood that it was just business, but like Yamauchi like was kind of salty about it. And other people were like, yeah, Nintendo told us don't even bother effing coming in through the door ever again. So,
yeah, I'd love to know like the full story, the full truth behind that. But you're never going to get it. But Leon's story was just fantastic. I also seem to recall, according to that same oral history, Square Enix straight up told Nintendo, look, your system has to be, number one, it has to be more powerful. Number two, it really has to have CDs. And Yamauchi told them to take a hike. So they tried.
The interesting thing about Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles, of course, was that it tied into, it's very much of its time because it tied into Nintendo's big initiative to have the GBA connect to the GameCube.
Yeah.
And of course, you had to have four GBAs, which was suboptimal.
Yeah, and I believe four link cables.
Yes, and four link cables, which... Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles was a good game.
I have to say this much for it. It had a fantastic soundtrack. I still listen to it.
Yeah, excellent soundtrack. A very enjoyable group multiplayer game. Because mm-hmm. you had one person having to carry the pot, because the pot was what was protecting you from the dangers, and you had to protect the pot because there was the poison mist and everything. But yeah, very cool little cooperative multiplayer action RPG that I don't feel like ever really got truly appreciated in its time. Yeah. I think later Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicle games became more Monster Hunter-ish, I think.
I haven't played any of them, but I think this one, that the re-release coming out, has online features, so that's a pretty good substitute.
I don't care about online features, but I think that if I get it, I'm just going to play it with my friends.
Ah.
And it's finally a chance to be able to play Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles without a GBA.
Yeah, and a GameCube and a bunch of link cables.
Yeah, so lots of Final Fantasies coming out. And one more other thing that I think that is getting a little underrated is Game Freak just announced a new RPG called Town.
Yes.
Which I don't think anybody is really... I don't think it's on anybody's radar, but I think it should be on people's radar because Game Freak puts out really good games.
They really do.
Not working on Pokemon.
Yeah, I mean, look at Pocket Card Jockey. It's one of the best games on the 3DS, frankly.
Yes, I totally agree.
So I am definitely looking forward to seeing more from this. And I believe they did like a kind of a rhythm RPG a while back that was also very good. They make very good games outside of Pokemon.
They also did Tembo the Badass Elephant.
That's right.
How can you not love Tembo?
Exactly.
I will definitely be keeping an eye on this one. It looks very pretty.
Like, it does.
From a graphical standpoint. And Game Freak always does a really good job of sneaking in really interesting mechanics into its games. And of course, these guys are, you know, they're the Pokemon guys. They know how to make an RPG.
So. Yeah, there's a reason Nintendo has been using them for basically as long as Pokemon's been around.
So lots to be excited about for the Nintendo Switch in 2019. I think, you know, the Switch has been kind of dominated by ports to some extent, to the point that, frankly, it's gotten a little tiresome at times. But so I'm not that thrilled. You know, I'm not Like, oh my God, game changer. Look at all these Final Fantasy games. Final right. Fantasy Pocket Edition finally coming to Nintendo Switch.
Yay.
But I do think that is nice. And I will be especially excited if they can get Final Fantasies 1 through 6 and more or less complete the complete collection on the Nintendo Switch, except for 11 and 14. But who gives a crap about 11? Final Fantasy 11 fans care about 11, I know. But
I actually have my former grooming manager. Her husband still plays Final Fantasy 11 from time to time with his friends.
That's weird.
Well, I still play Ragnarok Online sometimes. So.
There's a much better Final Fantasy RPG out there. It's called Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah, I know. But some people just love old-ass MMORPGs.
I'm still mad that it was numbered.
Yeah, that is very confusing to me.
Just screw them for numbering it. Just like screw them for numbering Dragon Quest X.
Yeah, that makes me even madder.
Yeah, it's like, in my mind, you have disrupted the numbering scheme. Now forever, it's broken. It's the OCD part of me talking. We're going to move on to interview with Brian Fargo, so don't go away. All right, with me now is a man who should need no introduction. He is the founder of In Exile Entertainment. He has made many wonderful games, most especially The Bard's Tale, and that is Brian Fargo. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
It's been a big week for you, Brian. I see you're releasing Bard's Tale 4. Wasteland 2 just came to the Nintendo Switch. We just got a remastered version of the original Bard's Tale. Tell me some of your emotions as all these games are coming out.
I guess when it rains, it pours, right? Every day is a different emotion. I mean, always the new titles always work me up the most, right? I mean, with Bard's Tale 4, it's a brand new thing. The conversions are great. It's been awesome because it's amazing how many people on the Switch, for example, already own the game and are excited to replay it again. And a portable size. So that's cool. I love reading that, especially because we put so much depth into the game that there's things that you would never even notice unless you did play it two or three times. So that's cool. And then the remaster was kind of an appetizer for Bard's Tale 4. And we charted it in the top role-playing games on Steam, which was awesome for a game that's 30 years old. And that's been fun for people that either haven't played it or to kind of remind them of why they liked it to begin with. And then, of course, here comes the big baby, Bard's Tale 4, next Tuesday.
So with Bard's Tale 4, I got to play it. GDC came out as a beta for backers back in July. And the first thing that it threw me back to was the Return to Zork, which was an adventure game that came out in 1993, 94. That was notable for the first time because you got to see the White House. Like, it was right there. And I was thinking of the same thing with Bard's Tale 4. You get to see Scarabray in all of its glory. And, I mean, it's kind of a really cool moment, isn't it?
It is a great moment. I remember another great moment was being in Mangar's Tower and going, oh, this is fantastic. This is what it looks like. And dealing with some of those old nemesis again. It's only a tiny spoiler, but, a lot of those... the icons of the series make their way back. So, because I have the same or similar nostalgia to people. So when I'm, there's Roscoe's, the grandson of Roscoe's running his shop. That's like, oh yeah, I remember that. And when they play Falcon Teen's Fury. And so I think it's a nice mix of new material with a lot of the old ones that hit the chords of making you feel good.
Tell me about recreating these settings in a way that feels like that really touches upon like the nostalgia of the original Bard's Tale that is faithful, but also feels fresh and interesting.
Yeah, and that's always the tricky part, right? Which is that especially as it relates to world building, because like I know that. One is there's a lot of people that played the game at a point in their lives that they can never recreate themselves. which is they were in college or they played it when they were young with their parents or whatever. And so, you know, there's an emotional attachment to those things. And then there's also a perceived memory of how deep the world really was, right? And like world building, for example, has come a long way since those games. You couldn't, for example, come out with a fantasy game today and, you know, also have ninjas and Nazis and all the crazy stuff we did in some of the Bardstell series. So we really want to look back and say, what are the things that we thought were super important to people, which is they wanted a dungeon explorer. They want to walk around and feel like they're into it. They want to have a party that they control, so they get all the tactical combat that goes with it, you know, some of the puzzle solving, the music, you know. So we tried to strike on all of the things that we thought were the people told us that they loved with the original series, but bring it into a more modern package to recognize that there are some gameplay ways of approaching things that have changed since then, right? Anything from save games to UI, etc. So our job is to kind of thread that needle between making sure that the old players are feeling like they're revisiting a comfortable place, yet players that have never played the game and have only played games for the last 10 years and are only familiar with modern gaming are also comfortable, that they don't feel like they're just being thrown back to some kind of remaster or something. So I feel pretty darn good that we sort of straddled that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Bard's Tale was, of course, a really interesting inflection point in RPG history. People should go check out Jeremy Parrish's ongoing series about the history of RPGs, in which he makes Bard's Tale in a kind of an important centerpiece of that. And he talks about how it was one of the second wave of RPGs that came in the 80s. And one of the things that was really interesting was that it put a big emphasis on buffs and debuffs through the kind of eponymous bard. And one of the things that you've always seemed to really emphasize in your games is this idea of kind of nonviolent solutions to things. And I feel like that's a big part of Bard's Tale. Is it safe to say that those are the things that you found most important to nail in Bard's Tale 4?
Well, I think that so when you're doing this type of game, you combat's going to be the main centerpiece of what you're going to be doing the most time, and so that we know that that's the core of the product. And so to me, I look at it that I think what's important is that there are many different ways to play it, right? To me, I want you to play a Bard's Tale 4, and you tell me, well, I went with, you know, all bards, or I went with this kind of combination, or I ended up using a lot of summon creatures, or, you know, or my party was constantly drunk, and that worked well for me. You know, whatever style it is, I've always liked to make it so that you can make your own style of approaching the play to a strategy that you sort of feel like you've developed yourself, and in which case you have, because we put a lot of variables in. We create a lot of edge cases. And so we set it up so that it has a sort of an emergent style to what's best. So even within our own company, we find people playing it in different ways. I was watching a guy play the other day, and I was like, wow, I never had tried. It didn't even occur to me to try that before. And to me, that's what I like to see.
One of the things that I find really interesting about Bard's Tale 4 is that you incorporate puzzles into the actual weapons. And I'm curious, could you tell me a little bit about designing that and also why you decided to do that, to add that gameplay layer to it?
You know, I was really moved by playing some puzzle games. I don't know if you ever played The Room and on iOS. And I thought, you know, it's so interesting, just the kind of the physical manipulation of objects. And I say physical, but you're still on a screen. But that sense of it, I found very rewarding, satisfying. And I thought, gosh, you know, you're always exploring sort of at a macro level. It's like, you know, we're always looking into space, but, you know, there's also the microscope. So wouldn't it be fun to take some of the weapons and bury some really deep secrets into them that you could unveil to make them more powerful? And I think it really resonated. People responded super positively towards it. I mean, we, you know, you get these weapons early on in the game, and you know, the first puzzle is pretty easy. The second one's not too bad, but you know, the third and fourth, not so easy. And it's going to be fun because there'll be these weapons in the game that people, you know, they'll be digging through Reddit to figure out how to unlock, you know, the ultimate of what they can do. So, and I think what's also kind of a fun emotion is that. And it's actually, I think some people won't even figure it out for a long time, right? They'll pick it up, and then one day they'll look at it in their inventory, because you could take any item in your inventory and sort of rotate it around and look at it, right? But all of a sudden you do it with that one, and all of a sudden you see something you'd never seen before. You think, God, I've been playing the whole game, and I could have just inserted a gem into the hilt and made my life easier. So I like the sense of discovery at a smaller level in addition to the big level.
This is an In Exile game. In Exile's first RPG. You guys have obviously done Torment, Tides of Numenera, Wasteland 2, but it seems to me that Bard's Tale 4 is probably the most elaborate, most technically sophisticated RPG that you've done to date. You put on Unreal Engine 4. Tell me a little bit about like developing an RPG that, while the other games were certainly complicated, they weren't as technically. Perhaps as ambitious as Bard's Tale 4.
Yeah, with Bard's Tale 4, to me, it started off with immersion was the most important thing. And so when I, you know, when I did the original Bard's Tale series, I mean, you know, it started off with Wizardry back in the day, and then Bard's Tale was in color, you know, wow, right? And then, you know, then we had like Stonekeep, which was full screen, but, you know, but it's not like today's visuals. So I haven't been, there hasn't been much in terms of people taking a look at this category and saying, let's use modern technology and really go for it, right? And I won't say we're the only dungeon crawl, right? I mean, some people, they consider Dark Souls a dungeon crawl. But as far as, you know, sort of non-Twitch-oriented, of course, there was Grimrock, which was a solid product. But I wanted to sort of use all the latest and greatest technology and visual effects guys to see what it's like to feel like you're in a dungeon. And so that was charter number one, and that led us towards the Unreal Engine. We have a lot of wonderful 3D artists and VFX artists here, and it was an opportunity to show off what we could do using all that. So you are correct in that it was, I mean, it's an ambitious game. It's probably the most expensive one we've done. The models themselves, it's different when you're isometric and the models are very small, you know, you can have hundreds of them, but you know, you can't do hundreds of super high res models. So it's a different approach. Each one has to really, you know, really look super. I get to
play the game like a new person would. And I really, it's like, it reminded me of why I fell in love with this category to begin with. Right. Cause I'm not a Fortnite kind of guy or a Twitch kind of guy. You know, that's not my thing. So I really love games where I can sit back and take in the atmosphere, you know, like BioShock to me was did a wonderful job of atmosphere. I love that. So To have kind of the dungeon crawl where I get to sit back and I'm not rushed and I can take it all in and I can feel I'm there and kind of that feeling of like, ah, just 30 more minutes, you know, playing 30 more minutes, one more dungeon, one more thing. It completely took me over in that way. And it took me back to why I loved that category and fell in love with the gaming to begin with.
I think the thing that I find most interesting is we think of first-person dungeon crawls as kind of this old-school PC genre subgenre, but Japan kind of borrowed that genre and turned it into games like Etrian Odyssey and that kind of thing and had a lot of success for it. So it's been really interesting to see it come back to kind of its Western roots with Bard's Tale 4. Just out of curiosity, have you played any kind of the Japanese versions of, say, like Wizardry or Etrian Odyssey or that kind of thing?
The only one I kind of fooled around a little bit was with Persona 5, and it is sort of ironic because I think the consoles have done
have focused more on kind of party-based role-playing games in many ways. And I have heard comparisons to some of the Japanese games. And even Puzzles and Dragons is really, it's a dungeon crawl to some degree. So I don't know why it was abandoned as a category here or considered secondary, because it's so darn much fun. It'll be interesting to see if we can kind of bring that back and make that something that other developers focus on again. Because you've been playing these for a long time, so you know how much fun they can be.
You have a really complicated and interesting relationship with Bard's Tale. For a long time, you didn't have the actual license for the gameplay. I think you had the name. And so as a result, you made kind of an action RPG in the mid-2000s. This is your chance to kind of finally revisit this series that you have so much history with. What's that been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to revisit properly. And as you say, I just didn't have the rights to the copyright back in 2002. So we ended up kind of doing this fun little parody of role-playing games. But this is a real serious sort of take at what Bard's Tale would have been. And one of the things I like to remind people of is that it's almost not Bard's Tale 4, but Bard's Tale 14, right? Meaning, like, what would have happened had the series continued, right? Because obviously a Bard's Tale 4 that came out in 1995 would be very different than perhaps what we're doing here. I mean, most undoubtedly. I love revisiting these old franchises. I hope I get, you know, I want to keep working on them. They're great. So it's been bliss, really. It's been all the nostalgia and finding the touch points. And again, just remembering how much fun this style of gameplay is.
So you've done Bard's Tale. You're working on Wasteland 3. You've done Torment Tides of Numenera. Where to next? Are you going to do Torment Tides of Numenera 2, or are you going to pick up something new, do you think?
I'd like to have a combination of... I don't mind doing these old ones. I quite enjoy it. But I think something new is probably going to be on the horizon.
Oh, that'd be interesting. So jumping over to Wasteland 2 really quickly, when I talked to you during the development of Torment Tides of Numenera, I asked, would this game perhaps be a good fit for the Nintendo Switch? And you were like, yeah, I don't think it's going to be a good fit for the Nintendo Switch. It's a different audience, that kind of thing. But with Wasteland 2 coming out on the Switch, you seem to have come around quite a bit on Nintendo's console.
I did. I took a lot of grief for that answer, too, actually. So, yeah, you know, that was really my bad. In my mind, I must have been showing my age, because I thought of the Nintendo audience as being younger. And so I didn't think it'd be something they'd enjoy. But talking to our fans, they were like, no, we really would love that. And so based upon that, I said, all right, well, maybe it would be great for the Switch. And so we did it. Technically, it was very difficult. It's a large footprint. And sure enough, they love it. So, yeah, that was, it was probably not a good response, but, people love it now, so it's great. So, you know, if our fans are happy, we're happy.
So it's been several years now since Wasteland 2 has come out. Looking back on it, was it kind of everything that you kind of hoped that it would be?
Yeah. I mean, I think it set us up very well to do more. I mean, it's got a very high Metacritic. Our users love it. I mean, it's the most asked about thing I do. When is the next Wasteland? I mean, it just comes up constantly. So I think in that way, mission accomplished. I love post-apocalyptic, obviously. I mean, been involved with this and Fallout. So, I'm pretty happy with it. I'm very happy with it. Me as a creator, we always look at, you know, ways to do better. I very much like the direction we're taking with Wasteland 3. It's going to be a much tighter experience and deeper in many ways. So I think the multiplayer aspects of it is going to be fun for friends to play it with each other in a narrative structure.
We got a pretty meaty update on Wasteland 3 back in April. But for the most part, you guys seem to have had your heads down working on it. I see that you have a targeted date for 2019. Could you kind of give us an update on how things are going in general in Wasteland 3?
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, we really wanted to get our hands around the storytelling at a deep level. And what I mean by that is like every conversation in the game, every interaction, you can already play the game from start to finish. The graphics don't look good, and there's lots of issues with it, but all the bones are there. And so now we spend the next year really filling out the bones, making sure that we're selling the right points, that we're striking the right nuanced approach to things, to making sure combat is tactically great and visually super rewarding. We're bringing the camera down for key conversations in the game. So we want those to be sort of wildly strange and entertaining. So it's a real step up in terms of experience from Wasteland 2 to 3.
Yeah, it sounds like Wasteland 2 was your take of we're going back to the old days of RPGs. And in that respect, it's very geared toward the hardcore. It's very deliberate in its pace, in its systems and everything. Whereas Wasteland 3 is like, now let us have a more modern take on the series. Is that kind of fair to say?
A little bit. I mean, I'll give you an example. Like, so with Wasteland 1, the key, you just type in a single word, and things had progressed more towards conversation and dialogue trees. Well, we were afraid to go too far because we didn't want to, abandon the roots of number one too much. But then as we got it, we put the keywords in, and then it was, well, you would choose a keyword, but it, let's say the keyword was help. Well, am I asking for help? or am I offering help? You know, what's going on? So then we ended up having to put sentence structure to be clear as to what each word you would say. So now we're like, look, people prefer dialogue trees. That's the way to go. And so it was a hybrid. So I think that's an example of something where we think it's going to make the product much better to get away from trying to back into a keyword system by giving a full dialogue structure like the Fallout series or any of the other ones. Right. So, things like that we're innovating on, certainly visually. We don't want to lose some of the hardcoreness, right? I mean, it's mature, period, end of story. It's got some rough subject matter, and we think it's a harsh, brutal world, and we're not going to lose that. We might do things like focus on accessibility for the first hour. So I think it's a little daunting, for example, in Wasteland 2 that you got to create all your characters right at square zero. You know, maybe we let you work your way into it over a small period of time rather than throw it all at you at one time. Things like that for accessibility. But in many ways, it'll still be hardcore.
So how's In Exile Entertainment going generally? You guys have several games under your belt now. You seem to be moving into more ambitious projects.
If you think about how the business has changed in just the last few years, in 2014, the AA budgets were probably around $5 million, roughly, right? And so you got the big companies, the small companies, but they're us, Obsidian, Larian, Ninja Theory, right? In the last couple of years, now all of a sudden you're seeing the, quote, the AA's start spending $15 million plus. And so that has greatly changed. So all of us are needing to step up our game. Because of the success people are having that are spending 10 or 15 million, and the expectations on the consumer is kind of pushing us along to spend more. So that has greatly changed our business in terms of user expectations. But as usual, we are beholden to hoping our product finds its audience. It's all about that. We Bard's Tale 4, I mean, people say they want single player role playing games. You know, they want deep games. They want uniqueness, which I think we've done with the combat system. So we're in the user's hands to hope they really, really, like I said, resonates with what they enjoy playing, because that way I can keep doing it.
Once you fail to have that happen, then you've got a real problem because of the huge expenses at hand. But that's just the reality of the entertainment business.
So that's partly why Bard's Tale 4 is so much more elaborate than perhaps some of your previous games from a visual standpoint, just because you're feeling pressure to really step up your game from a visual standpoint and the amount of money you spend.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, even for the guys that are spending more than me, you know, I mean, we're over 10, but you know, I mean, we try to reflect it in the price, right? So we're not trying to get $60 for our game. In fact, Bard's Tale, I have to say, we're $35 for a 40-plus hour game with those visuals. I think that's great. We couldn't charge $60 for this because of, you know, people are going to look at Battlefield or Call of Duty, and they don't care what the budgets are. They're going to just look at the visuals, end of story, right? So I think so. Anyway, I'm sort of rambling on a little bit here, but we have had to step up our game, and here we are.
But for the most part, you guys, things seem to be going pretty well for you, and it seems like the space for kind of interesting, independent, really deep RPGs is really good right now. I mean, certainly from the perspective of the success of Divinity: Original Sin, for example.
Yeah, I mean, we all are envious at that. There's no question. I mean, ask me next week how I feel after we go live. I mean, you know, I'm always worried, right? I mean, that's my job as CEO, to always be concerned. I mean, early previews from the press were fantastic. Our backers like it. We put out the videos. It's, you know, 99-1 positive. I mean, it's all the signs are there. But it's still a super scary business because there's so many great games coming out every single week. You know, it's Spider-Man came out, Tomb Raider came out today. We're coming out Tuesday. There's another RPG coming out the following week. You know, people can only afford so much, right? So it's got to be really, really special. So in that way, it's always scary no matter what.
Are you guys planning on sticking with crowdfunding going forward?
It depends on the success of the games. Maybe. Part of me really likes it because I like the connection. And Wasteland 3 is going to be a fun one because we share in the profits with our fans, which is kind of cool. So I suspect they're going to love that if they start making money. There is a point, I think, like if you're Larian and you sell 2.5 million copies of a game, it's kind of hard to go back to crowdfunding. I think people might not look on it kindly, but there are parts, like I said, I've always said there's parts of it I like that are secondary to the funding, which is the connection of the community and helping to amplify the signal of our games coming out, right? We have a small army of backers with 20 or 30,000 people that have all prepaid for it. They've all made it happen. They're all going to get their copies, and we're hoping they're going to love it and tell all their friends, and then all of a sudden we have a big rep force recommending to buy our games.
So looking back, I suppose this is my final question, looking back on Wasteland and Torment, Tides of Numenera, what's been the single biggest lesson that you've learned that you've taken into Bard's Tale 4? I know that Torment, Tides of Numenera in particular needed a few updates to really truly get up to speed.
Well, I think the biggest thing you have to do with crowdfunding, and we did not do a good job with this with Torment, was that under promise and over deliver, right? The day one. And so with this, we have, I mean, like I said, we told our backers, the people that, yeah, it'd be a 25 hour game. And it's a 40 plus hour game. I mean, it's massive. You know, we never said we were going to have, you know, all that music and all the top Gallic singers in the world. And I think they thought they were going to be in a dungeon the whole time. They didn't know they're going to be traveling across the sea and going into towns and into villages and you know, through the forest. Their expectations were lower than what was actually delivered. And I think that's probably the most important thing to try to take away from a crowdfunding campaign, which is always tricky, right? Because there's a friction. On one hand, you want to get them excited enough to back you, but you want to keep some things back so that when they get it, they're pleasantly surprised. And I think we've done that in spades with this.
I know you're a busy guy, but are you going to be playing Fallout 76 when it comes out in a couple months?
Most definitely. I'll be very curious to see what how that feels, right? I understand they're trying to thread a couple of different needles there, which is interesting. And so I definitely want to see how that feels when it comes out.
Yeah, it's interesting because Wasteland 3 is going multiplayer and Fallout's going multiplayer. Everybody's going multiplayer.
Well, but you know, with us with Wasteland 3, though, it's like there's no. I mean, it's a first player narrative game through and through, right? It just happens to be that we don't set it up so you bring a stranger in and play. It's only for your friends, and so you basically are able to split it up and play with it. So. You know, Divinity did a great job, right? I don't think people would consider that any kind of takeaway from the single player experience. So we're trying to do it in a way that's actually going to beef it up and focus heavily on how can the narrative be improved by two of us playing together. So I think that I understand the kind of the angst of some of those franchises going multiplayer, but at least for us with Wasteland, we're still focused on that experience in a big way.
Brian Fargo, thanks for coming on the podcast. Bard's Tale 4, available on PC. Look forward to it tomorrow as the release of this podcast. And Brian, look forward to chatting with you again. All right, we're back with Nadia. And Nadia, last week we reviewed Dragon Quest XI. No spoilers, so if you missed that, you should go totally check that out. And here are some comments from the readers, as usual. MacCom26 says, I've been pumped for DQ11 for a very long time, but the comments about battling saber cubs sent some unexpected chills. Let's get a mod on that ASAP, please.
Yeah, there's actually someone put up a video that I retweeted of the saber cub just kind of frolicking on its back while during the battle scene. So it's just like, ugh, god damn it, Square Enix.
I'm going to murder you now. You're so cute.
Aww. Kill or be killed, Kat.
No. I'm happy to allow this adorable little thing to rip my throat out.
Okay, that's fair.
Great Lord Absu says he's great in battle and is enjoyably written, but I would like Silvando a lot more if he had a better voice actor. The guy who plays him has a few decent moments here and there, but more than not, he defaults to an unconvincing imitation of Fez from the 70s show, but with, shall we say, lispier, stereotypically gay mannerisms.
I didn't hear a lisp, to be honest with you. I guess some people may perceive it that way. Silvando has continued to be a very interesting, divisive character. For example, Jim Sterling talked about him on his show, and Sterling, if I'm not mistaken, is bi, and he adores Silvando because Jim, is so into like that kind of campy sort of flair. He goes around dressing as like flair, like wrestlers with like a lot of flair, and he has his own character, Duke Dardcore, who is like a aristocrat who reads YouTube comments. And so I could see like someone being really into that sort of thing, like just loving Silvando. But on the other hand, I have another person on my tweet who just found him really offensive. So I guess it's just really person by person thing.
Cam Chow says, I'm loving DQ11 so far. The music isn't great, but honestly, an orchestra isn't going to save the soundtrack. The real problem is the lack of variety. The overworld music... That overworld music might honestly be the worst piece of Japanese game music I've heard in a long time. Though I might not hate it so much if it wasn't the song I'm Here being played most of the time. Forest, desert, swamp, island, cursed farmland, doesn't matter. It's all the same damn song. Such a baffling design choice. I guess it's because it's just old school style overworld music, but it just doesn't feel right in a game like this, where there really isn't that old style overworld map and everything is zoomed in and detailed. I don't know, man. There could be one thing I would change. I just want some more music.
Actually, without going into too much detail, the post-game does change up the map music. Sorry, it's still a remix of an old song, but it's good to have a change.
Rider Kicker says, you gals are giving me intense FOMO in regards to DQ11 because I don't have the funds to buy it at the moment. DQ8 was a masterpiece of a game, and Level 5 managed to keep me hooked onto the PS2 for more than 2 hours at a time, especially compared to the other entries in the series, which I did beat, but only because they were portable. If both of you say it expands on the concept of 8 and it does so much more, crying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very much an 8, but a really great 8. An 8-2.
Satellite of Love says, Silvando is but a taste of the glory that is Olivier, Bishy Sparkles. Earthbound's run over Lobby enemies sing is one of those things that got lost in Gen 5 in the rush for loading, loading, slow pan, intro animations, cinematic battles.
That's very true. That's a good point.
Well, there's a reason that the SNES was the best for console RPGs.
That's a conversation for another day, but I am really torn between the SNES and the PS1, to be honest with you.
Oh, no, the SNES beat the crap out of the PS1.
I don't know. I just love the PS1 RPGs so much.
They just don't hold up. I mean, yeah, Suikoden 2 holds up, but that's because it's a SNES RPG in PS1 form.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I still love, like, Breath of Fire 3, and I still love Final Fantasy 7. We were just talking about that. And Final Fantasy 9, I still love that. Like,
yeah, but 7 and 9 just aren't as good as the SNES games.
Like I said, conversation for another day.
It's a conversation we're having now, Nadia. You got 2 hours? Let's do this.
What do you mean we got 2 hours?
The challenger says, funny, I was just talking to my sister about how RPGs start off difficult and then get progressively easier the further you make it into the story. I came to the conclusion that I like the old school difficulty scaling. However, it doesn't hurt to change it up or throw out an established norm every once in a while. Change is necessary too. Contrast that with something like RE4, where the whole difficulty curve is flipped. And finally, JohnnyBoy407 says, I like Earthbound, but I'm not in like with it. I guess what he means is in love with it. Ditto to all the points made, the podcast about how battles work in the world and how there's no big world map, just a lot of interconnected areas like Pokemon. I also appreciated the HP counter and so much that you could save a character from dying if you could heal them from a lethal blow before their HP ran out. Had a bunch of interesting ideas that you didn't see in very many of its contemporaries or predecessors. No love for Pooh? I'm actually curious if Kat or Nadia ever went through the grind fest to get his Sword of Kings. Hell no, I did it. Because yeah, that was so random. I hate random drops. Fuck random drops.
We're talking about 1 in 256 or something ridiculous like that. I think I actually responded to that comment directly with no and hell no.
Absolutely not. But Earthbound, number 16 on our top 25 RPG countdown list, and Mass Effect's number 15. You're probably wondering, where's number 14 on our top 25 RPG list? Well, that's going to be next week, because we got a little bit of a surprise coming up next week. Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be a whole week's worth of surprises. So please look for that, and number 14 on our list totally ties into that. So it'll be fun, right, Nadia? It's going to be fun. I'm going to have a good time.
I'm racking my brain trying to remember what the surprise was. Yes, yes, it'll be fun. I agree.
And next is Blood God. It's a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. We're in the middle of review season at the moment. You can, I mean, if you're into that kind of thing, just go check out all of my reviews of the sports games. We also got reviews of Spider-Man, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, Destiny, pretty much all the coverage that you could possibly want. I know that people who listen to this podcast are often skewed toward Japanese games. Well, Katie wrote a really excellent retrospective slash kind of, yeah, like look back from Suda51 about Killer 7. It was an excellent article. Even if you didn't play the original, I totally recommend checking it out. And Nadia, what have you been up to this week?
Oh, let's see. I actually just put up an article. Apparently Japan has Kirby cat hoods. So I put up a little article rating the cat hoods because I think that's very important. And I also wrote about a clinic in Australia that's using Skyrim to advertise vasectomies. So as you can see, I am, as usual, the one who's out there hitting the hard topic because no one else will do it.
Of course, now that I'm out of the sports game milieu, now I'm moving on to Forza Horizon. That's so RPG-like, zoom, zoom. Right? Driving. Yeah.
Can I pretend it's a horse?
No, I'm not gonna. I want to get back to DQ11 and Witcher 3, frankly, but duty calls.
Duty calls, and also Valkyria Chronicles 4, which I'm getting into.
Oh, yeah, that's a game we'll be talking about. We'll be talking about that on our podcast relatively soon. But so, yeah, follow us on Twitter at @_catbot. Nadia's @NadiaOxford. Are you enjoying the podcast? Please leave us a review over on iTunes. Tell us how wonderful we are. We love hearing from people who enjoy our show, and it helps make the podcast more visible. Thanks to Nadia and, of course, Brian Fargo for coming on the show. We'll be back next week, and until then, happy adventuring.